From South Carolina Public Radio, this is the South Carolina Lead. I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode was recorded on March 22nd, 2024, in South Carolina Public Radio Studios here in Columbia. In this episode, we catch up with friends of the pod, Jeffrey Collins with the Associated Press and Joe Bustos with the state newspaper.
Shout out.
To talk about the House's expanded school voucher program, judicial reform, primaries, and more. We take a look at the latest Fed decision to hold interest rates steady, and we get a report from Scott Morgan on evictions in the state. Plus, the Biden administration cancels debt for 78,000 public service workers. Are you one of them? But one debt that will never be cleared is that if you don't call us, 803-563-7169, there will be no forgiveness to this podcast. We want to know what you're doing. Maybe you got your student loan debt canceled. That'd be awesome if you called us and let us know. 803-563-7169. Also, spring is here, folks. How's the pollen in your neck of the woods?
Terrible!
803-563-7169. And here at South Carolina Public Radio, we want to provide in-depth, transparent, and factual coverage of the upcoming June primaries and the November election, from federal down to the state and local level. We want you and your voice to be part of that process. South Carolina Public Radio was recently chosen to be part of the America Amplified Election 2024 initiative. As part of that initiative, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the upcoming June primaries? At southcarolinapublicradio.org, you can submit your questions in a form embedded in our article about the America Amplified Project. There's a link right there on the website, folks. Let us know what you're interested in. There have been some interesting developments in the State House as we march towards sine die, the last day of the two-year session on May 9th at 5 p.m. I caught up with Jeffrey Collins with the Associated Press and Joe Bustos with the state newspaper on This Week in South Carolina to bring us up to speed on all things State House related, including the House's passage of its expanded K-12 voucher program, more on quote-unquote judicial reform, and the upcoming primaries. I kicked this off by asking Jeffrey about that voucher pilot program, which was passed into law not even a year ago, that the House voted to expand.
Well, it's moving fast, at least for now. I mean, you know, the bill was proposed at the very end of February, and it passed the House, got its key approval last night. What it does is the original 2023 law has caps on how much a family can earn to be able to get the scholarship. It's going to be around $120,000 when it's all said, you know, when we get to the end of the program's phase in in about 3 years. And it has some other requirements like caps on how many students can be in the program. Well, the House bill that passed this week, it eliminates the income cap, so anyone can get one of these. It eliminates that a student had to be in public school the year before, so if you've been in private school your entire educational career, you can now get one of these. And the big deal is it completely eliminates any cap on the number of students involved. So they're put $30 million aside to expand it, but in theory, there could be a lot more money that goes into it depending on how many people enter. They had more applicants than the 5,000 scholarships they had to give out because that window to apply ended. So proponents say, hey, you know, this is, there's a lot of demand right now. But the future of it's a little bit uncertain. I mean, Senate Majority Leader Shane Massey says, hey, we'd like to wait and see how this operates before, you know, that we put it in place kind of like a three-year pilot program to see how it was going to work. And then the other thing that complicates all this is the laws before the Supreme Court right now, the South Carolina Supreme Court, which heard arguments 2 weeks ago on whether or not it's constitutional. South Carolina's constitution bans direct aid given to anything but public schools. The folks that say the law is okay say, well, the money goes to a trust fund and parents pull from it and then they give to the private school. So it's not like the state gives the money directly to the private schools, but that's going to be up to the state Supreme Court to determine. So all this could be proven moot in a few months when they issue their ruling.
And then it sounds like the Senate, like you were saying, is kind of throwing a little cold water on this whole thing and waiting to see where things are going to go first.
Yeah, I think that the overwhelming sentiment in the Senate, at least Republican leadership and what they were saying last week, is we just want to see if it's going to work. I mean, let's before we expand it, let's see what happens. Maybe we can tweak it in some ways and maybe we can't expand it. I think there's people that want to expand in the Senate, but they just want to wait and see how it does and what problems there are and things of that nature. So, yes, it's a popular thing. I mean, they've been pushing for this for 20 years in South Carolina, so it's not a surprise that they tried to push harder to get to it. I mean, Mark Sanford, it was a huge thing for him. Nikki Haley, to a certain extent, it was a big deal for her. I mean, it's been a big deal for governors and education people, so not a surprise they tried to push it, just that it came so quickly after they passed this first program.
Mm-hmm. Good talking points for Republicans in an election year, too.
Very much so, yes.
Joe, House floor action over the budget wasn't as contentious this year as it was last year, specifically between the members of the far-right House Freedom Caucus and the Republican Caucus, a little infighting there. But one of the major points of contention still was over DEI, or diversity, equity, inclusion efforts within institutions of higher education. So what happened there with this legislation? What's moving forward? How's that maybe mitigating those arguments?
So last year, when we went to the DEI debate during the budget, it slowed down everything. The Freedom Caucus put up a bunch of amendments to try to strip colleges and universities of that funding, at least money that they use for DEI, and then they eventually brought those down with the agreement that there would be discussion on a bill to ban DEI, or at least address DEI at colleges and universities. That bill got heard this week in a committee. It passed out of the committee. So that bill would ban diversity, equity, and inclusion considerations in hiring and ban mandatory diversity training at colleges and universities. So now we'll see how it goes in the full House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and just tell me a little bit about the vibe in the House when it came to the budget this year, too. I mean, again, not as contentious. It seems like everyone was just maybe working to get things done because it is an election year.
there still was those amendments from the Freedom Caucus. They were trying to strip money out, try to move it towards other purposes, to what they considered core functions of government. They tried to strip funding from the Arts Commission. Mm-hmm. Those efforts ultimately failed, but they got the $13.2 billion budget passed out of the House relatively easy. They got it done in 2 days, so we all survived that one.
Yeah. Jeffrey, when we talk about judicial reform being ramped up, last year it really took a lot of, a lot of attention. We started hearing more and more about it because of what the state Supreme Court did last January when they overturned that 6-week abortion ban. That really kind of lit the fuse for everyone saying we need to reform how we elect judges in the state, which is done by the legislature. But the Senate passed its version of judicial reform this week. Can we actually call it reform? What does the bill do? What does it not do?
Yeah, that's the first thing I was going to say, is no one can really agree on what it is. I mean, some people call it judicial reform. There's some people that say it's legislative reform because it changes how the legislature operates in electing judges. But what the Senate bill does is it expands. There's a commission that screens judges to see if they're qualified. And it expands the number of that to 12. And for the first time, it gives the governor appointment set board. So it's a 4-4-4 system, 4 from the House, 4 from the Senate, 4 by the governor. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about whether legislators who are attorneys should be on that panel. They get to stay. And in fact, they probably will dominate the House and the Senate appointments. The governor's appointments are people from outside the legislature. They're attorneys, somebody from the prosecution side, somebody from the defense side. There's a retired judge that is required, the governor's required to appoint. So that changes the makeup of that board. Also, they were only allowed to send out 3 candidates. Now they can send out up to 6. They have to send out all the qualified candidates up to 6. If there's more than 6, then they can make a choice and narrow that field down a little. There's some changes in how the election takes place. The General Assembly chooses the judges based right now on a majority, right? So it's 170 members, 124 House, 46 senators. Whoever gets the majority wins. Now you have to get a majority under the Senate bill of each House, which could create an interesting situation where a candidate gets the majority of the House members and a majority of the votes, but can't get over 23 senators. So we end up going to another election and another election in the cycle. So this all goes over to the House right now. Speaker Merle Smith indicated that he tends to, if the Senate passed something, that they would probably take up their issue, which should tell you that we're probably not going to get any further than where we're at. No additional reforms, so to speak. Mm-hmm. That's probably where we're at. We're not going to have something like where we eliminate lawyer legislators from the panel or something like that. So the House is going to take it up. We have 21 legislative days left. That's probably enough time to figure it out, but, you know, something will probably happen.
About a minute left, Jeffrey. I want to ask you about the 2-week filing period for all 124 House members, 46 Senate members, and the 7 congressional seats that are up for re-election this year. That closes on April 1st, but I want to get your take on just what you're seeing right now, what you're thinking it's going to look like when it comes to what primaries might look like come June 11th.
There are four senators who aren't running for re-election, two in the upstate, and they're Republicans, two in the Midlands who are Democrats, including Nikki Setzler, who's been in the Senate since I was two. So there will be a very big, there will be some changes there. And I mean, it was redistricting. So there are districts that, I mean, South Carolina is growing, and it's growing in places where rural Democrats like Gerald Malloy or Kent Williams are going to have to find areas where, you know, they're getting Republican areas put in there. So it could be an interesting general election. And then there are the three Republican women who will all probably get primary challengers who, you know, they're the ones that were against the total abortion ban, you know, making it more of a 6-week heartbeat ban in South Carolina. Those folks will probably face challengers too. So it'd be very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And Joe, I want to wrap up really quick, but just 20 seconds on the House really quick.
All right. We might see Kirkman Finley file. He is raising money. And at least three Freedom Caucus members have primary challengers.
There's more to that interview, which you can find on youtube.com/South Carolina ETV. That's where all of our content lives. Yes, the internet. Sticking with the State House, the Senate and the House have passed resolutions dealing with state funding and what they can take up after May 9th. Both chambers agreed on a continuing resolution, which would keep the state government funded at current levels should the Republican-controlled legislature not pass a budget by June 30th, which is not expected to happen. This is just a safeguard. But while session ends on May 9th, lawmakers will still need to meet to hash out details on bills that have passed both chambers and are in conference committees. Those committees are made up of three House and three Senate members. There will be more hashing going on because there'll be meetings to hash out the differences over the budget and dates for both chambers to come in to approve the compromise or the hashed out budget and gubernatorial vetoes. Sometimes, like last year, that stretches into June and can even disrupt some travel plans. But with primaries on June 11th, expect things to move quickly this year. Both chambers have approved a continuing resolution and a sign-e-die resolution that dictates what they can do after May 9th. Without a sign-e-die resolution, the governor can call lawmakers back to get work done like he did last year. They don't like that. The Senate also set S-95 for special order. That gives the bill, which would make the Comptroller General an appointed position by the governor with confirmation by the Senate, debate priority status. The legislation, if approved, would require voters to okay the constitutional change, which comes in light of the accounting oversight that rocked the state last year. While no money was missing, a $3.5 billion accounting error over the past decade led to the resignation of Comptroller General Richard Ekstrom. The last time lawmakers approved a statewide constitutional office move from popular election to gubernatorial appointment was in 2018, and it was the Superintendent of Education. However, voters rejected the move 60-40, and the position remains on the ballot. Amid the accounting errors, perhaps voters could have a change of heart this go-around. Who knows? Unlike the well-known and more political Superintendent of Education position, the Comptroller General is the state's chief accountant and fiscal watchdog. We'll see. The bill still has to make it through the Senate and the House. All right, enough of the State House. Let's move to Washington, our nation's capital, where on Friday, the U.S. House of Representatives voted 286-134 to approve a bipartisan $1.2 trillion spending bill to fund the government through September and avoid a partial government shutdown.
So fun!
101 Republicans and 185 Democrats supported the measure. Not everyone was happy with what was in and what wasn't in the measure. I know, compromise is hard in Congress, guys. Looking at our congressional delegation, Republican Joe Wilson was the only Republican in the delegation to join the lone Democrat, Jim Clyburn, in supporting the measure. Representatives Jeff Duncan, Russell Fry, Nancy Mace, Ralph Norman, and William Timmons voted against the spending. Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene is already moving to oust Speaker Mike Johnson. We'll be watching that. The legislation, which is six spending bills in a 1,012-page package, heads to the Senate, which is expected to approve it and send it to President Joe Biden before 12:01 a.m. Saturday. All right, while we're in Washington, let's pivot to national economic news. Yeah, keep it. Okay. Don't be too happy. Why are we doing that? Because everyone loves the economy, right? Just some reason, though, right? Even though it remains very strong and grew by 3.1% last year, thanks to resilient consumer spending by consumers like you, the housing market was still a bit subdued. Nevertheless, GDP is expected to shrink to 2.1% this year. However, that's still positive. That's a positive 2.1%. That's not a recession. And now you're saying, oh, Gavin, gas is $3.22 a gallon. Inflation is running at 3.15% annualized. Mortgage rates are 7%. And
shrinkflation.
I don't have as many potato chips in my bag of potato chips.
Wow.
Chester Cheeto says, keep eating Cheetos.
Okay.
That was Chester Cheeto in studio.
Oh my God.
You know what I say? Drive a more fuel-efficient car and do it slower. Okay, you guys are speeding out there. I see you. Shop smarter. Understand that mortgage rates are in line with their historic norms. And wait to refi in a few years. Or you know what? Wait to buy if you can. And sock some cash away to take advantage of these high interest rates. Okay?
Yes.
That's coming from your unlicensed personal financial advisor. It's my recommendations, guys. And if you're at Maritime right now, I got a whole different thing for you guys. Tune into the Patreon. Hit the Patreon. Subscribe there. I got so much more you can take advantage of. Maritime loopholes, guys. But enough about me. Let's hear from Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, who spoke to the media on Wednesday following the Federal Open Market Committee meeting in which interest rates were held steady in the range of 5.25 to 5.5%.
The economy has made considerable progress toward our dual mandate objectives. Inflation has eased substantially while the labor market has remained strong. And that is very good news. But inflation is still too high. Ongoing progress in bringing it down is not assured. And the path forward is uncertain. We are fully committed to returning inflation to our 2% goal. Restoring price stability is essential to achieve a sustainably strong labor market that benefits all. Today, the FOMC decided to leave our policy interest rate unchanged and to continue to reduce our securities holdings. Our restrictive stance of monetary policy has been putting downward pressure on economic activity and inflation. As labor market tightness has eased and progress on inflation has continued, the risks to achieving our employment and inflation goals are moving into better balance.
Ugh, land news. But when are rates going to start ticking back down to maritime levels, you ask? Well, that remains the tightrope the Fed continues to walk, especially amid stubborn inflation that ticked up this year. Here's Powell's outlook.
We know that reducing policy restraint too soon or too much could result in a reversal of the progress we have seen on inflation and ultimately require even tighter policy to get inflation back to 2%. At the same time, reducing policy restraint too late or too little could unduly weaken economic activity and employment. In considering any adjustments to the target range for the federal funds rate, the committee will carefully assess incoming data, the evolving outlook, and the balance of risks.
Sticking with the economy, we also have a report from South Carolina Public Radio's Scott Morgan on eviction rates in the state. South Carolina is home to the most eviction-prone large city in the United States, North Charleston. We're also home to the most eviction-prone mid-sized city in the United States, with St. Andrews. And 47 of the 100 most eviction-prone rural small cities in the country. Here's Scott's report.
When the Eviction Lab first released its online database of eviction rates in the U.S., South Carolina had worse numbers than literally everywhere. And when those data were updated to go through 2018, not much changed. And now, here we are in 2024. And?
The data hasn't changed. Like, the Eviction Lab report came out. A lot of folks in the state scrambled together to try to fix this system. Now, 5 years later, it's still in the same position.
This is Glynis Hagens. She's a Skadden Fellow at NAACP. As the result of a federal court decision that allows South Carolina NAACP to automatically collect online court records, the agency has built its own database of up-to-date eviction numbers for the state, broken down by county, and, Hagens says, to be refreshed every 4 to 6 weeks. Those data were released for the first time on March 14th, and they tell a familiar story.
South Carolina's housing issues have not fixed themselves, even with the good work that they're doing in Charleston with housing court and the work to be able to expand housing court across the state. There's still a need for some change.
The data show that since March of 2020 through this past January, landlords filed 377,000 eviction filings in South Carolina. That includes tens of thousands of evictions filed during the year and a half that federal and state moratoriums on eviction were in effect. Faring worst over the past 4 years is Dillon County, where 31 evictions were filed for every 100 renter households. 12 other counties statistically had 20 or more filings per 100 rental households, and those are a mix of rural small counties like Marion, Greenwood, and Laurens, and larger urban counties like Richland, Greenville, and Spartanburg.
We're in the space of, like, actually deep crisis. The bleeding has not stopped in South Carolina.
Kenya Cummings is the Director of Strategy and Development for the South Carolina Housing Justice Network in North Charleston, who worries about how repeat eviction filings dog tenants for years.
We have a lot of tenants that are often asking us the question of, how do I expunge this? And there's actually not a real clear pathway forward around that, which just creates a lot of issues for folks that are trying to find housing, but also for folks who are trying to fill vacancies.
And this gets at two things that South Carolina NAACP, the Housing Justice Network, and a host of other partner agencies want to make clear about the release of very recent eviction data. One is, no one is looking to make villains or victims out of anyone. These agencies just want the real numbers to tell the real story of eviction in South Carolina. Two, publishing these numbers is a teachable moment.
I think part of the solution is definitely landlord education. It's also tenant education. Tenants need to understand what housing rights they have in the state of South Carolina, because often you watch something on TV, it looks exciting. Someone says, withhold your rent, and you think that that's a viable path forward for yourself. And it's not in the state of South Carolina.
Glynis Hagens agrees that way too much misinformation circulates the social media landscape, and that's what's feeding answers to AI searches.
I was on ChatGPT one day just playing around, and I was like, how do I handle an eviction in South Carolina? And completely out of left field, they were like, you can go to South Carolina Department of, and it was a department I had never heard of, and you can file a complaint for one of these issues, and it was like discrimination, eviction. And it was just completely made up information.
What troubles Hagens, so, is that those AI fever dream answers sound eerily close to what she hears from a lot of real life tenants who are facing very real life eviction.
I did a series of talks with Homeless No More, and the information that I heard there was just super alarming. And so correcting that information is going to be an uphill battle already. And so if we can get folks true information and some resources, I think we're already fighting a battle that has sadly begun.
Hagen says the true aim of getting continually updated eviction numbers in front of people is to use that information as a vehicle to begin conversations about help. That's the reason why so many nonprofits, from SC Appleseed and Pro Bono Charleston to the ACLU and the South Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, are in on this. They want tenants to know that there is a network of help for their legal and personal needs in a state with few tenant protections.
You can find that report and more on southcarolinapublicradio.org. Also, while you're there, hit that donate button. Your donation to the ETV Endowment supports our ability to purchase quality programming to fill the airwaves you listen to, and it also helps support our mission to educate and inform South Carolinians, like this podcast.
Aww.
Now, on the way out, some good news for thousands of public service workers in South Carolina. The Biden administration is canceling some of y'all's student loan debt. The administration announced on Thursday that since October 1st, 2021, it has canceled $1.3 billion in student loans for nearly 16,000 South Carolinians. The administration says that nearly 4 million Americans have had their student loan debt canceled since Biden has been in office. If you're one of the 78,000 nationwide who are eligible for debt forgiveness in this latest round, you will receive an email regarding the move next week, according to the White House. This cancellation is due to fixes made for borrowers who are in the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. Welcome to the wind down section, our little break from the news. We're glad you're here. This is our chance to talk about things that are not the news, but sometimes the news trickles in here, doesn't it, AT Shire producer of the Lead Podcast?
So we try our hardest to keep it separate.
I bar the door.
It's mostly a severance type situation where we forget exactly what we said in the earlier part of the show, and it doesn't try to get in here. But if you've ever seen Severance, you know that doesn't work. Anyway, Gavin, it's so good to be here.
It's Friday.
Friday.
yay.
Honestly, I'm feeling better. The COVID, I think, is
has it evaporated?
It's finally behind me.
That's good.
I think I've slept enough hours to finally get over it. I woke up this morning and was just like, I think I don't feel like garbage.
And then you open the door and it's like, pollen.
Yeah, the pollen. And then I felt like garbage again. It was supposed to rain all day and wash away the pollen
into the big pollen puddles.
And it has not happened, and I need it to happen.
I wore my boots today just for that.
Anyway, Gavin, we got some calls. We're going to double dip, okay? Mm. That means two.
We don't have as many chips in our bag because of
shrinkflation.
Oh, well,
I saved two chips to dip.
We're fighting the shrinkflation with our calls here, okay?
Please call and help us fight shrinkflation.
Are you ready? Again, this is a debt that you can never fully repay, okay?
There's no, Uncle Joe's not coming here to cancel this debt, guys, okay?
Canceling this debt. This is a life debt.
You got to tithe if you're listening to us.
It's written on your soul, okay? Anyway, Gavin, are you ready for the first call?
Yes, please.
Hi, this is Eunice Lehmacher from Clemson, South Carolina, although I'm actually in Pennsylvania right now.
Go Birds!
And I'm calling to say I support getting rid of an old refrigerator. Refrigerators are one of the main users of energy, and old refrigerators especially so. So I encourage your dad to go ahead and throw that out and get a new one and a smaller one. We have many more energy efficient options. So keeping old refrigerators in the garage is a good way to increase your energy bill, as is that electric bill you talked about in the pod, that our Congress, our state houses are considering. They're going to put a lot more money into gas power as opposed to increasing our solar power in the state, which would be a way to reduce our energy bills. But it is South Carolina. Anyway, I support your dad, AT. Bye.
Oh, plus one for Papa Shire there from Eunice. Thank you, Eunice.
You're killing me. I understand the argument of more energy efficient, more new, easier on the environment, but also, like, these new fridges break all the time. And so, like, is it more efficient if you're going through more fridges?
Well, I will say this.
Okay, Gavin, Gavin weighs in.
Gavin's gavel.
My father, the founder of this podcast, who I inherited it from.
Yes.
I'm a Nepo baby, yes.
Yeah, okay, it's true.
They had a fridge that was under their home warranty. So I think when you're talking about fridges breaking and things breaking, get that home warranty because the fridge is perfectly fine. The only thing that broke was the ice maker, which they never really used anyway. They got enough money from that to buy a brand new fridge.
Yeah,
and now that old fridge lives in the garage.
There are so many fridges. We're going through so many fridges. I saw an environmentalist talking about cars, if we want to correlate this to cars, where they said it's good to drive fuel-efficient cars, but it doesn't mean get rid of your current car and buy a fuel-efficient car because that car still exists. You're just creating more cars.
If you do get rid of your car, though, you can always donate it to ETV and the ETV endowment.
What a pitch. What a pivot.
But I also say, we were talking about this. We never had a garage fridge growing up, but we did have a big old deep freeze. And I don't think that baby is anywhere near energy efficient, but like, my God, I don't think we ever thought it out because it was just like things were in there, like loaves of bread and like
forever.
Random ground beef that my mother would wrap in aluminum foil and just throw in there. I'm like, oh my God.
And if Indiana Jones number 4 taught us anything, you can survive a nuclear bomb in those things. Anyway.
Or in your fridge.
Are you ready for this next call? This caller, great friend of the pod. He has some advice for you for how you attacked St. Patty's Day. So are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, here we go.
Gavin, AT, it's your best bud, CJ. I'm driving in my pollen-covered car, hands-free talking, so no worries. But I was just listening to the wind down on St. Pat's, and, you know, Gavin, you could have given your official, non-official beer man sponsor of the lead a call, and you wouldn't have had to wait in any long lines for IDs or anything. But hope you guys are doing great. AT, I hope you get clear of the COVID sometime soon. So you can be amongst the masses and then, you know, breathe in all this nice pollen that has my head feeling great currently. But I hope everyone's doing well going into springtime. Excited for Gavin's spring-summer travels, his beach time, and to hear all about that.
hope you enjoy some nice Peak Drift seltzers wherever you may be. All right, guys. Great talk to you. See ya. Bye.
CJ, love hearing from you, bud, and love you calling from the road. I know he's doing hands-free, but whenever I call hands-free, I always keep my eyes closed.
Yeah, I like to visualize who I'm speaking to, mostly.
People that have to look at you when you're talking and driving, don't do that. Just look straight ahead.
Come on.
You don't have to do that. But we love hearing from guys, folks while they're driving, do it hands-free, or pull over and call us. But I also hate to use this position of any power or privilege to use it for VIP passes or... you know, women's basketball tickets, if anyone has any.
Women's basketball tickets. Yes.
I would hate that. I would never do that. But also all the pollen. The other day, Monday, right? So it rained on Sunday somewhat, but then all the pollen still came on Monday.
Yes.
And my car
we
looked
need
like
the
it
rain.
Was just, we love the rain.
We need, we
love
we
the
stand.
Rain.
We
We're
stand.
Not against
we stand.
Not against,
Thank
I'm not
you,
sitting
Queen, for saying that, yes. Thank you, Mama.
Mama, kudos for sharing, for spilling. But, I was like, dang, my car's looking so janky right now. And I was I can't drive this into the ETV parking lot. The people, you guys, it's like a high school parking lot. People mm-hmm. are out there just judging everyone's car.
Yeah.
So I had to do a quick hose down, and that's all it takes sometimes. It was just disgusting to see it all come off.
I do want, real quick, he didn't mention this, but I do know from hanging out with CJ a lot, he is pro old fridge. I know that he's got a great oldie in the garage.
Has your father had any update? Has he thrown it away? Is it still existing?
It still exists. He's a last minute guy. He's gonna procrastinate, so we have a lot of time to herring you, my father. You know what I mean? I did get a message from Roman, who created an Instagram called HVAC Friend to help teacher Roman created this to help convince my father to save the fridge.
Wow.
So everyone go find HVAC Friend on Instagram.
Wow. Loving this. I want to see a picture of this. Is it like an old
it's,
school
it's
fridge?
It's like a Kenmore fridge from 1990, maybe 89.
Oh.
I mean, it's been working since then. Yeah. That doesn't happen. It's never been... They only moved it because we got a new fridge in 1996.
This is your daughter's legacy here.
Yes.
This is her inheritance.
It is her podcast. Absolutely right. This is going to be little baby's pod. Okay. Anyway, Gavin, I hope you have a good weekend.
Yes.
Hit the outro. More fridge conversation, please. Okay? This is what the elites don't want us talking about. So... please.
And we're going to do it. We're going to do it. Be like Eunice. Be like CJ. Give us a shout. Let us
exactly.
know. Keep the conversation going, folks.
Yes.
And if you're out there covered in pollen, please call us. Sneeze on camera. Sneeze on phone.
Yes.
We love that.
Call the car donation line and just say, I have a great fridge for you. Anyway, Gavin, hit the outro. Goodbye.
Thanks, y'all. You can always show us your appreciation like CJ and Eunice did by leaving us a voicemail at 803-563-7169. Or if you don't want to do that, you can always leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We love that, too. You can stay up to date with the latest news on SCETV.org and SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. And don't forget to support your local newspapers. For the South Carolina Lead, I'm Gavin Jackson. Be well, South Carolina.
These ones, I don't think so. These ones are financing their Jimmy Buffett condo. You know what I mean? Big time. Bad rate. Bad rate.